Did you see the stylish kids in the riot? Shoveled up like mugs at the night on fire, wombles bleed, truncheons and shields. You know I cherish you, my love. Welcome to the Young IPA Podcast. I'm James, this is Pete.
G'day everyone.
It is the 30th of November, this is episode 88 and we are dusty.
Well, a little bit.
We are dusty.
Because?
So thank you to everyone that came out to the 75th anniversary dinner last night at Crown Palladium. Great event, great celebration of the IPA's successes over the years.
It's not every day you turn 75, James.
It is not every day you turn 75. And absolutely tremendous night, so thanks so much for everyone coming.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's fair enough that the people, like our events team here, I think they get the Q&A clap of the week at the start of the show.
They do, and in a normally we do the Q&A clap as a sort of patronising thing, but this is a genuine Q&A
this
clap.
Is a genuine...
Okay. Thank you.
No, so look, Tony Jones really loves your work.
He does. Yeah, so what do we all think of the event? Because we had a good time. Pete and I got to hold a painting, which was fun.
Yeah.
We had this like auction part of it, and Tim Storia was kind enough to donate a painting to the IPA that we would then auction off, and the money would go back for our research. I think it was like valued at 50K, I want to say.
Well, it was valued at 40K because that's what we sold it for. But
right, okay.
The painting was worth a lot of money.
Yeah.
And they, for some reason, gave us the responsibility of holding it.
Yeah, so we had to go on stage while there was being auctioned, just holding it. We got to wear white gloves, which was kind
of
cool.
Just a bit of eye candy, I think.
Just to help, did you come with the painting?
Yeah. Lots of people said.
Yeah, I have never been more scared of dropping something in my life than holding that painting. That was all I could think about all day, was just do not drop the painting.
It's just in your head.
And then it was. And then when we got up on stage in front of all these people and were holding a painting, I'd realized I'd had no game plan as to what I was going to do on stage. It's like, I was so busy about not dropping the painting. I was like, do I look at Pete? Do I look at the painting? Do I look at the crowd? And then ended up trying to do all three. So I don't know what that looked like to everyone.
Well, don't
send your feedback.
Don't beat yourself up about it, mate. I think we did a good job.
I'm overanalyzing holding a painting.
Absolutely.
Cool. Nina, what was your favorite part of the night?
Favorite part? I think I've got two. One is when I saw Pete on stage holding the painting and smirking.
Yep.
That was smirking. It was a smile of enjoyment.
Well,
holding the wine bottle, that was a smirk.
Yeah.
Who's holding?
That was Pete.
That was Pete as well. And also for the second one was the video.
The video, yeah. So we played a video just talking about a few of the things that the IPA has been doing over the last few years and a few of the people that we've been working with. Hopefully you guys get to see the video eventually, but it's talking about Peter Reid, Callum Thwaite, Bill Leake, Bob Carter.
Yep.
Yeah. So you really like the video?
I like it. I love it. It's just poignant and I actually shed a tear.
Did you really?
I did.
I thought you had no emotions, but there you go.
Nina's got emotions, just a teaspoonful of emotions there.
I have to agree with you, Nina. I thought the video was great and I thought the best part of the video was when Gung Leake, so Bill Leake's widow, said, what was it? Hang on. Good trouble.
Yeah.
So Bill Leake was apologising to her for creating trouble and she said, no, that's okay because it's good trouble. And I thought that's just such a good description.
Yeah, exactly.
Of a lot of the stuff that we do here.
Yeah. And she started to say like the IPA causes good trouble out there and it's a lot of trouble that a lot of people agree with.
Which is such a good description. My other highlight was Nina.
Yep.
When we were at the bar, Club 23 afterwards, Warnie's nightclub where the after party was.
Mm-hmm.
Nina.
No Warnie that night. I tried to start a rumor that he was there just to see if I could get people up and about.
Yeah.
Everyone just saw through it immediately.
Bring back the old Warnie. That's what I'll say. Not this new thin. Anyway. Me and Nina had a shot.
Oh, really?
And then we immediately
Where was I?
I don't know. I don't know where you were.
I don't even know that I was having a shot with Pete.
Well, it was your idea. And then as soon as we had it, she goes, let's have another one. And I was like, no, I can't do it.
I'm being wound up here. There's no way I can do it.
And then Nina goes, you're so soft. And she walked
beat
off.
You up.
Yep.
None of this is true.
That was another one of my highlights.
Yeah, write a reply, Nina.
None of this are true.
Okay, well, I got an actual highlight. meeting the campus coordinators. So we had every single campus coordinator from our Generation Liberty program was at the event. They got to introduce themselves to the crowd. And for a lot of us here at the IPA, it's the first, like, you know, we email and talk to them, but first time face-to-face. Very impressive group of young people.
Yeah.
Sprightly, I would say.
Oh, full of hope and optimism.
Yeah.
And life.
Yeah, exactly. Like, we went up to do Proof Hate, What Did I Miss yesterday? And they were singing a song as they were, like, setting up for the event.
They were joyful. Joyful, happy warriors.
Yeah.
We don't normally get them all in the same room because they are from all over Australia.
Yeah, so we have people from, like, Western Australia. QUT was one there, so.
The Gong.
The Gong, indeed, Wollongong.
Newcastle.
Yep.
where Silverchair's from.
Yep, are they?
Yep.
Huge. Daniel Johns, shout out. So we're going to be recording something with them later this afternoon that hopefully we're going to play for you guys in the next couple of weeks. Chance for you guys to get to know our campus coordinators. And just once again, if you are out there, you're under 25, you're at uni, and you're not seeing a whole lot of places where you can express yourself freely and engage with new ideas such as classical liberalism and libertarianism, get involved with our Generation Liberty program, talk to our campus coordinators. We've got the Facebook page. You can contact us here and email Renee Gorman, the national manager of our Generation Liberty program. It's a really, really cool thing that we're doing, and it's a great way to meet people who are like-minded to yourself.
That's a good point. It's not just about the ideas, it's about making friends.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a community.
Yeah. So that's all the reflections I've got from the dinner. So I think we'll move on to, as you can tell, it's a subdued podcast today, but I think, we're heroes for doing a show.
I don't think hero is the wrong word. I think hero is probably underselling it.
Yeah. Oh, I'm on 3 hours of sleep, I reckon, and I'm usually cranky if I get less than 8. So if I am cranky or irritable in this podcast, I want to get ahead of it and just say I'm sorry. So we'll move on.
Noted.
All right, let's talk. Okay, so the main story, and a lot of things have been said so far about it, so I'm not sure how much new we can add to it. Victorian election,
yep.
Absolute disaster for the Libs.
Well, I can't believe the Oprah policy didn't work.
The Oprah? Oh, yeah, the free TVs.
TVs for everyone.
Yep.
And fridges.
And mystery boxes. This morning, ABC's got it at 53 seats for the ALP. You need 45 to win, so 53 seats for the ALP.
That's more.
That is more than they've won. 24 for the Liberal, 24 for the Coalition, 3 others with 8 up for grabs. So absolute disaster. The Liberals are about to, they might lose Hawthorne. They got really close to losing Brighton. These are absolute seats that the Liberals have never lost or haven't lost for decades and decades and decades. So absolute, disaster of a campaign. We're going to be talking to Daniel Wild later in the show, IPA research fellow here. He's going to be breaking down a few of the policy positions that the Liberals weren't getting over the line and what it means to the Liberal parties in other states and federally. What can they learn from what happened to the Victorian Liberals? Mm-hmm. And then what does the future of Victoria look under a Labor government?
That's right. All important stuff. We won't go over it now because we are talking with Daniel later. But I was speaking to Les from the LDP last night, who was sat next to me, whose surname I've forgotten. I'm sorry.
Liberal Democrat Party.
That's correct. Yep. And they did pretty well. So it's not all bad news.
Yeah, yeah. So it's like, at the end of we don't really care how the Liberal Party does. We just care about the policy positions that the parties have.
That's right.
So
we care about the ideas.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. So as long as some... and I saw the Liberal Dems where I was voting did pretty well. So there's some slivers of signs that people still really care about liberty. But yeah, absolute disaster for the Liberals. I think we'll talk another story here on personal tax rates, babe.
Well, you know me and tax, James.
Yeah.
Like two peas in a pod. Well,
you send your money to the Cayman Islands and then it stays there.
Yeah, I manage my millions to avoid tax. But the personal tax rate, the average personal tax rate in Australia, because of bracket creep, will hit 20% on average personal tax rate, by 2020/21 financial year, if nothing changes between now and then, which probably will. Both parties will probably take tax cuts to the election. But that's from Deloitte Access Economics, and that figure, 20%, is the second highest average personal income tax in history. In Australia, which is very high. The highest was under John Howard in 2000 when it was really high, and then there were massive cuts because they introduced the GST. So that's really high. As I said, both parties will probably take tax cuts to the election. But as I said yesterday, what did I miss? This is clearly an example of those massive right-wing policies that are destroying the coalition.
Yeah, you can't elect a government with all these right-wing policies increasing taxes on personal income.
Yeah,
you can't do it.
You've got to appeal to the mainstream of Australia, and mainstream Australians hate tax cuts.
Yes, they do they ever.
They love
riots in the street.
They love really high tax.
Riots in the street. So we'll now go to an interview. So as I said, we've got Daniel Wild coming up about the Victorian election. We're also going to be talking to Brendan O'Neill again. So we're going to be playing part one of that interview. He was kind enough to sit down with us for an hour this week.
Yeah.
Very kind. So it's a really good conversation. So today we're going to be talking about his new book, Anti-Woke. That's available from Connecticut Publishing. And we're also going to be talking to him about Brexit. And then next week is going to be getting into freedom of speech, university safetyism, and what he's thinking about the future. And what's next for Brendan O'Neill? So that's all going to be next week's show. So Brendan O'Neill, in Australia with the IPA, he gave the keynote speech, I would say. I mean, there was a lot of great speeches. I think Brendan would have been the keynote.
That was another highlight of last night, actually.
Yeah, yeah. So Brendan's speech was fantastic. Janet Albrechtson's speech was fantastic. Andrew Bolt's speech, Dad's speech, that was also fantastic. Mm. All three gave shout-outs to the podcast, which was pretty cool. So
those bribes paid.
Don't. Yeah.
I would say, just about that anti-woke book
that
Brendan O'Neill wrote, I saw this on the Connor Court website yesterday. If you order that before the end of today, Friday, the last day of November.
30th.
You will get a personally signed edition.
I shall catch you.
Thank you, James. You'll get a personally signed edition.
Yes. So
you've got to order by the end of today.
By the end of today.
Do it right
Friday the 30th.
Do it right now. If you do it right now, you won't forget.
Yeah. And it's a really great book. A lot of great essays by Brendan O'Neill. Such an interesting, compelling thinker.
Christmas coming up.
Christmas is coming up. Good call.
Buy it for the work individual in your life.
Yes. So that's all available from Connor Court Publishing. So we'll go to those interviews now. So other things I'll run through. So the IPA this week, a lot of it's been all hands on deck trying to get this anniversary dinner going, which has been very good. But if you do want to read John and Daniel's forensic investigation into what happened to the Victorian Liberal Party. They had an op-ed in the Australian Financial Review that's also available on our website. And I'll give another shout out to a friend of the show, new research fellow here at the IPA, Kurt Wallace's report on the sharing economy, because now that Daniel Andrews has been returned with a pretty large majority, that does not bode well for Victoria's sharing economy. So get your Uber Eats while you can, because that might be on the way out. Yeah. Well, not on the way out, but it's going to be, they're going to have to increase prices.
You just have to, a taxi will deliver it.
Yeah, yeah.
And it'll cost $25.
And go the wrong way. So let's go to those interviews now. But before we do, we should talk membership, Nina, because everything that the IPA does, the 75 years we've been here, it's all possible because of the support of our members and donors. Yeah. So if people want to become a member, if people want to become a donor, what can they do?
Well, if you know someone wants to become a member, you want to donate, just visit our website, ipa.org.au, and click on the donation button if you want to donate, or click on join button if you want to become a member. And starting as low as $22 per year, you'll become a voice of freedom in Australia.
Very cool. Let's go to those interviews now. Okay, we now welcome back to the show. Very exciting. Brendan O'Neill, editor of the great, great website Spiked. Welcome back to the show.
Hey, how's it going?
Very well. So you're in Australia. Tomorrow night you are going to be speaking at our 75th anniversary gala dinner, which is going to be a great event. And you're also in Australia, and Connor Court Publishing is releasing the book Anti-Woke, which is a selection of essays by yourself. So go out there and get the book from Connor Court Publishing. So I guess we'll start there. So why are you anti-woke?
I'm anti-woke. Why am I anti-woke? I'm anti-woke because being woke is a bad thing. Being woke basically means you think you're superior to everyone else. You think you're more morally switched on. You know all the right words to use. You know all the right phrases. You're politically correct in every single situation. You don't laugh at offensive jokes. All that nonsense is basically what adds up to being woke. And so it's kind of a very practiced style of existence. It's kind of a way of showing that you are better than everyone else, you're better than ordinary people because you're so kind of morally aware and so on. So that's in my mind what being woke means. It is, as far as I'm concerned, the most annoying word of the 21st century so far. So when I say I'm anti-woke, I basically mean, hopefully, that I'm a bit more chilled out than those people, a bit more willing to be offended and give offense, and not so uptight about every single issue.
I would expand the annoyingness of the word woke from the 21st century to just all of the English language. I think it's just pipped moist.
Forever. Yeah,
and
of all time.
I think it's really starting to go ahead.
Of course, Christmas is coming up, so run out there to Connor Court Press and get this for your most woke friend. But what explains the rise of wokeness?
That's a good question. I think it's largely down... I mean, woke people consider themselves left-wing. I mean, being woke means being left today. And my view, my somewhat unfashionable view, is that that's a complete and utter misreading of what it means to be left-wing. So I think wokeness springs from the demise of traditional left-wing politics. You know, being left used to be about being pro-economic growth. You know, it was about wanting more stuff for more people. Now it's about being anti-economic growth because you're so obsessed with saving the planet and so on. Being left-wing used to mean being pro-autonomy. You trusted that ordinary people were probably better at running things than priests or politicians or bureaucrats. Now it means the complete opposite of that. It means being pro-state. And being left-wing used to mean being universalist. It used to mean particularly believing in the universalism of class. The class was the great universalizing dynamic. Now, whether you agree with that or not, the point was at least it had that universalist component. Now it means being identitarian, separatist, forcing everyone back into those biological boxes that they spent so long trying to escape from. So I one of the things I find most distressing about modern politics is the extent to which the left has abandoned all of its traditional values. And I think wokeness is the end result. Wokeness, where you prove you're a good, decent left-wing person by being against, in fact, all the things that the left traditionally stood for.
Yeah, I'd add in freedom of speech to that as well. I think that's something we talked about last time you were on the show, but that was traditionally a left-wing campaign issue, I guess, and now it's very much a right-wing one.
Absolutely. The switch there has been astonishing. I mean, if you look back to particularly, you know, everyone will always say, what about Stalinism? Of course, Stalinism was never in favor of freedom of speech. But if you look at the Western left, if you look at the left in the West, particularly the anti-Stalinist left, which was a fairly substantial chunk of it, you know, in the 50s and 60s and 70s, in that kind of countercultural era, they were very pro-freedom of speech. They wanted freedom of speech for provocative literature, for dangerous art, for homosexual movies, for all sorts of things, which for communist literature, all the kind of things that generally right-wing politicians were in favor of banning. They would argue for freedom of speech for those things. There's been a complete and utter reversal. So now the left is often at the forefront of arguing for censorship. And the right, which is also very strange, has become the kind of leading force in the campaign for freedom of speech. So George Brandis, when I interviewed him here a few years ago, he made exactly this point. He made the point that we've gone from a situation where the left argued for freedom of speech and the right said, well, we can't really trust people to have freedom of speech because they're all a bit fickle and stupid, to now a situation where the right argues for freedom of speech and it's the left who thinks people are fickle and stupid and can't be trusted to see and hear all points of view. So that turnaround has been dramatic, and it's incredibly interesting.
So you personally, of course, used to be on the left as a younger person. Is it that change which caused you to move across or to move somewhere else?
Yeah, well, I don't call myself right-wing. I've never once in my life called myself right-wing. Everyone tells me I'm right-wing.
Yeah, a lot of other people have called you right-wing.
All the time. So who knows what I am. My view is that the terms left and right are not very useful anymore.
Yeah.
I think that old divide doesn't really stack up in the 21st century. I think it was incredibly important in the 19th century and for most of the 20th century. It was important in the sense that people define their whole existences through these terms. That's how they conceived of themselves. That's how they behaved. That's how they acted upon the world. You know, people were either left or right. And it had really important meaning. But I think it's fizzled out. I don't think those are the important dividing lines anymore. But people find the new political era, the kind of strange populist, this kind of unraveling of all the old post-war institutions and all the old left-right divides, people find that quite difficult to cope with. So what they do in response is they wrap themselves in the comfort blanket of the old political language. So they still go around saying, well, I'm definitely right-wing or I'm definitely left-wing, without thinking through what those terms mean. So it's often just an act by people who can't quite get to grips with the fact that politics is changing enormously.
Yeah, exactly. All right, I'm going to bring this back to wokeness. So another thing that's definitely rising in the same time as wokeness is just people posting on social media, and I think the two might sort of be hand in hand. Do you reckon, like, why do people need to post their woke beliefs or any beliefs that they have on social media? Like, what is that?
Well, it's referred to as virtue signaling, so people kind of advertise their virtue for the world to see. I think it's a very interesting phenomenon. I think it speaks to, again, it speaks to the kind of hollowed out nature of politics. So people need to derive a sense of meaning and a sense of purpose somehow. They struggle to do so in the kind of traditional methods. So I think one thing that has kind of risen to the fore is this very showy, very narcissistic declaration of decency. I'm a good person. It's really, I can't remember who it was, but a French philosopher decades ago referred to it as moral distinction, where the aim is not so much to say what you are for or what you're going to do or what you believe, but really is just to distinguish yourself morally from the other people. So it's a lot of it is about moral distinction. It's about saying, I'm good, and you can tell I'm good because those other people are so awful. So I think every time I see someone virtue signaling or doing these kind of narcissistic posts or boasting about how socially and racially and eco-aware they are, I always think in the process of doing that, they are, by definition, defining other people as bad, other people as wrong, other people as evil. So there's a narcissistic and a pretty callous element to that kind of politics.
All right, so you specifically mentioned white wokeness in this work. What is that, and how's it different from other wokeness, or just unpack that for us a little bit?
White wokeness, as in white people?
Yeah.
Yes, right. White people are very interesting at the moment. I think, well, a lot of people hate white people, white men in particular. They've become the bogeymen of our times. They are like the bad people, particularly old white men. You know, whenever anyone mentions old white men, they're really, you know, bearing down on that social section of society who they just think are responsible for all the ills of the world. And I think what's happened as a result of this kind of anti-whiteness, two things have happened as a result. Firstly, we've had the rise of the kind of new white pride movement, which I think is pretty obnoxious, particularly in the United States, where we have a situation where the more that the identitarian left is continually saying to people, you're a white man, you're a white man, that makes you a bad person, that means you shouldn't say these things, you shouldn't be in this place, then some people react to that by saying, okay, I'm a white man, so I will define myself as a white man, I will be proud of being a white man. So I think that kind of horrible, racist, alt-righty white pride movement that has risen up in recent years is in many ways a response to the identitarian left's pathologization of whiteness. So I think that's one of the dangerous consequences of today's naff left-wing politics. Another consequence is that you have these woke white people who are constantly self-flagellating in public and constantly saying, you know, it's always, they always say things like, dear white people. And you look at them and think, hold on, you're white, what's this all about? And they say, dear white people, please stop wearing your hair in cornrows, or please stop wearing Mexican hats, or, you know, please stop making sushi at home. I mean, they have all these bizarre rules about what white people are allowed to do, and they blame white people for all the ills of history, you know, the white race. They will say things like, white people don't know what it means to be enslaved. And you think to yourself, okay, there was this thing called the Holocaust 70 years ago, which was the last time we had mass slavery in the human race, so their history is a bit rusty. But the point is that this kind of self-flagellating anti-whiteness by white people, I find really quite disturbing, but also very interesting, because I think it really is actually a new form of white pride. Because what they're really saying is, we are good white people. We're aware, we're switched on, we know what's going on in the world, we're sensitive to the needs of other minority groups, we're better than those other white people, those uneducated white people, those uncouth white people, those white people who probably work with their hands for a living, those horrible white people. So what you end up with is this bizarre situation where it's white wokeness looks like self-hatred, but really it's a form of white pride. So I think it's pretty obnoxious. And I think it's actually the flip side of the white pride movement that we've seen rising in the US.
Very cool. All right, we'll move over to Brexit. So that's another big discussion. So Theresa May's Brexit deal has just passed all the other European leaders, 27 European leaders in just 33 minutes of discussion. So first up, that's got to be a clear sign that it's a great deal. Like, if it's got that much universal acknowledgement across Europe, got to be the best deal that they're going
to
get.
Best deal ever. Yeah. It's actually, not to put too fine a point on it, the deal is an abomination. I mean, it really genuinely is. You know, in June 2016, 17.4 million British people voted to leave the European Union, voted to take back control. That was the slogan of the campaign. Largest number of voters in British history ever to vote for anything. Huge, massive democratic cry. And what Theresa May has done is come up with a deal which not only doesn't take back control, but gives away more control than we were doing pre-2016 to the European. I mean, it is astonishing.
Yeah.
It is simply astonishing the extent to which this deal backtracks on the vote of 2016 and puts us in a worse position than we were when we were members of the European Union. So, for example, she would keep us beholden to customs union arrangements and even single market arrangements, which means that we would not be able to decide for ourselves how to trade with other nations or what tariffs to set or who to make trade deals with. You know, a fundamental part of a sovereign nation is the question of who you trade with. We wouldn't be able to do that. And would have to follow certain EU rules without having any input into them. But even worse than all of that, we wouldn't be able to wriggle free of this new arrangement without the say-so of the European Court of Justice. So Britain would become a vassal state. I mean, it is literally, we would become a colony of the European Union, where we would not be in control of some central parts of British public political life, and we wouldn't be able to assume control back over those things without the European Court of Justice, which none of us have any democratic authority over whatsoever, without their say-so. So what Theresa May has done to democracy and to the democratic vote of 2016 is utterly unforgivable. And I think what happens next is anyone's guess, but I can tell you that a lot of people in Britain are increasingly angry and are asking themselves, well, if we can't get what we want through the ballot box, what can we do? What other options do we have? And people feel like they are out of options. So we're moving into unpredictable territory.
Absolutely.
You mentioned before we came on air that you were optimistic about Brexit at yes. this point in time. Let's tell our audience why that is.
Even though I am really depressed about Theresa May's deal and about the European Union, which basically wrote the deal, I am still optimistic because I think Brexit, in my mind, Brexit is the best thing to happen to Western politics in about 50 years. I think it is so obviously a political rebellion. It's so obviously a restatement of people's desire for sovereignty, for democracy, for choice, for freedom. You know, the European Union is an incredibly illiberal, paternalistic, even dictatorial institution. And it has completely destroyed countries like Greece. It's had a very undemocratic impact in Italy, where it imposed an unelected technocratic government 5 years ago. It has had a devastating impact on the Irish economy, where it kind of imposed cuts that the Irish people didn't want and which haven't really worked. This is a fairly ruthless organization. So when the British people rebelled against it and rebelled against the advice of pretty much every single wing of the establishment who pleaded with us to vote Remain, that was a very clear signal that there's only so much crap that people are willing to put up with. And after a while, they will really be pushed to the edge. And I think that's exactly what happened with Brexit. It was basically people saying, voting for a very radical proposition, which is that maybe we know better how to run our lives than technocrats in Brussels do. And that's fundamentally what it boiled down to. So to my mind, Brexit is a kind of monumental middle finger to all the kind of technocrats and nanny states and banners and censors and restrictors of free trade and all those other things, which the European Union is the archetype of. And so I remain optimistic, even if Brexit is killed off or diluted or watered down so much that it's just Remain by another name, all of which look increasingly likely. I'm still optimistic about the fact that it happened and it can't be made to unhappen. It will always be there as this kind of mark in British history, this incredibly important moment in British history. And I think, judging from what people say to me when I travel around the world, I think it's also a beacon for lots of people who want to have fewer technocrats and bureaucrats and nanny statists on their back. And people across Europe in particular, but also in the US and in Australia, always ask me about Brexit. How's it going? Is it going to happen? It's really exciting. So they might undo Brexit in a practical sense, but they can never undo it in the historical sense.
Mm-hmm. You might have already, I think I know where you're going to go with this next question, but so the fact of like a no-deal Brexit, that was seen as a very least favourable thing a while ago. Now it's seen as the main alternative to Theresa May's plan. So do you reckon a no-deal Brexit would be better than May's plan? Do you reckon it's got a chance of getting up?
Yeah, I think a no-deal Brexit is now the only choice we have if we want to preserve British democracy. It's the only deal or non-deal which adheres to the thing that British people voted for, which was to leave the European Union. And that means leaving the customs union, the single market, and the European Court of Justice. Those are the three central components of the European Union, which have a very real negative impact on national sovereignty. So those are the three things people need to leave if we are going to leave the European Union. So I think no deal is the only thing that can bring that about. I think there is so much fear-mongering about no deal. I mean, the stories in the British press, you wouldn't believe them. One of the recent ones was, if we leave without a deal, there will be an outburst of gonorrhea across Britain, because apparently we won't have the right drugs to treat gonorrhea. People are saying that cancer patients will die, there won't be enough food. I mean, they're painting this kind of Cormac McCarthy-style dystopian view of what British life will be like if we leave without a deal. And it's backfiring entirely, because what they're basically saying is the European Union and its institutions won't have any interest in giving us like cancer drugs or all these other things that we need. And that's just making people think, well, that's just confirming for us what a ruthless, nasty organisation the European Union is, that it would seek to punish Brexit Britain by depriving us of life-saving drugs. So it's entirely backfiring. It's entirely made up. And everyone forgets that Britain's only been a member of the European Union since 1992/1993. Before that, there was the EEC, of course, but that was much more just a kind of trading body. 25 years, you know, we existed perfectly well before the European Union, before 1992, and we will exist perfectly well after it. So no deal, as far as I'm concerned, is the only reasonable option right now.
You mentioned you travel around the world. There's a lot of optimism about Brexit. This might seem like an obvious question, but is there much interest on the continent, you know, thinking, gee, that looks pretty good for the UK. Why don't we do that as well?
Yeah, I mean, I encounter a lot of negativity about Brexit as well, particularly when I go to New York and I kind of meet kind of New York liberals, because the New York Times is kind of insanely anti-Brexit. It's really bizarre. It's more anti-Brexit than even British liberal broadsheets. So I do meet people who say Brexit's the worst thing that's ever happened and so on. And I have to kind of put them right. But I also encounter a lot of positivity, and particularly in Europe, because there is a huge amount of Euroscepticism in Europe. Mm. And this is one reason why the European Union is so keen to make our exit from the EU painful, because it doesn't want other European peoples following suit. And it knows there's a genuine risk that that could happen. I mean, if you look at the rise of the League and the Five Star Movement in Italy, who now run the country, they are very Eurosceptic. There's growing Euroscepticism in France, of course, in Greece. Look at what's happened in Hungary, where Orbán is in power and is constantly in conflict with the European Union and is actually standing up to the European Union, to the winning much applause from Hungarian people for doing so. So the European Union feels that its legitimacy is being called into question, and they see Brexit as the kind of trigger for a lot of that. That's why they hate Brexit so much. That's why they hate British voters so much. I mean, they really do not like us. So, yes, I encounter a lot of European people who say we want to do that too. Do you think it's possible? But Brexit's had a twofold impact. Firstly, it's made lots of European people think we want to leave as well. But it's made a lot of European political classes think, oh my God, the European Union could actually fall apart. So they're kind of strengthening their attachment to the European Union, while ordinary people are kind of distancing from the European Union. That, coming back to the earlier question about the left-right divide and so on, I think in Europe, for example, a far more interesting divide than that right now is European Union or anti-European Union. That's a far more defining, kind of epoch-defining political divide in Europe right now than left and right.
Absolutely. So there's now, we're recording this on Wednesday, and overnight it's just been confirmed that Theresa May and Jeremy Corbyn are now going to get into a debate on television about what path Brexit should take.
That'd be a cracker.
It'd be like must-see TV, absolutely. Like just get them in the WWE ring. But anyway, these are two people who voted Remain and have done absolutely nothing to, you know, help out the Leave case or to get rid of the EU. So, like, why are these two voices there? Shouldn't there be someone who is consistently Leave from the start also on the panel?
Yeah, it's really weird. The political setup in Britain at the moment is really weird. So you have Theresa May, who is a Remainer, lifelong Remainer, now pretending to be a Brexiteer and saying, I will get the best Brexit, even though she won't. And you have Jeremy Corbyn, who was a lifelong Leaver, and was the only interesting thing about Jeremy Corbyn for all those years he was languishing on the back benches in Parliament, was that he was anti-EU. He was really strongly anti-EU. Because what the British left tends to forget is that there was always a very strong Eurosceptical line on the Labour left, among people like Tony Benn, who was a very famous Labour, left-wing Labour MP, Michael Foote, who was leader of the Labour Party in the early 1980s, Barbara Castle, who's a very famous Labour minister from the 1960s and the 1970s. She's the woman who brought in the Equal Pay Act in the United Kingdom. These people were all incredibly anti-EU in a very intellectual, convincing way. Jeremy Corbyn was influenced by those people, so he was always anti-EU as well, until it really mattered, until there was an actual referendum on it, and then he switched and campaigned for Remain, which, as far as I'm concerned, makes him a coward, a complete and utter coward, how someone would ditch their principles at the precise moment when those principles really, really mattered. So we have this bizarre... So the TV debate is
going to
be...
He's the first politician in history to do that as well. It's mind-blowing.
It's unbelievable.
Yeah.
This TV debate will be surreal, because it will be, as you say, two people who voted Remain. But even behind that, it's even more surreal, because you have the Remainer pretending to be a Brexiteer, Theresa May. The Brexiteer pretending to be a Remainer, Jeremy Corbyn. And as Nigel Farage said the other day, we just don't know what either of them believes. So it would be a debate between two people who we all know would not be telling the truth. It would be completely perverse. And without a genuine Brexiteer voice, which would represent the 52% who voted Brexit, it's just pointless.
Yeah, just on that, so who would you have representing the 52% on that debate?
Well, that's a good question. There are some very solid MPs. There's Gisela Stuart. Gisela Stuart is a German-born Labour MP who was the leader of Vote Leave, one of the most convincing voices in that movement. There's also a Labour MP called Kate Hoey, who's a Labour MP for a London constituency. She is one of the most articulate defenders of the Leave position, very, very principled opposition to the European Union. Of course, there's Nigel Farage, but he comes with a lot of baggage. People think he's a bit crazy. I actually think he's interesting and has been proven right on many things in relation to the European Union. So there are various voices who could do that. But the problem that we have is that 75% of members of parliament voted Remain. In the Labour Party, it's even worse. In the Labour Party, about 90% of MPs, I think maybe it's even 95%, 95% of Labour MPs voted Remain, and only about 5 or 6% voted Leave. So these are the parties are incredibly unrepresentative of the public mood, particularly the Labour Party. Everyone says Jeremy Corbyn's Labour is the people's party. He's the man of the people. But no political party in living memory has been as detached from public sentiment as the Labour Party currently is. So the question of who would go on TV and stand up for Brexit voters is unanswerable. And it's unanswerable because the political class is so far removed from ordinary people on the question of sovereignty and choice and democracy. Ordinary people are in favour of those things, and the political class aren't.
Any love for Jacob Rees-Mogg?
Oh, yeah, I do like Jacob Rees-Mogg. Not love, but I do like him. I think he's been very principled on Brexit, and he's been very consistent, which you can't say for many other members of the Tory party, including people like Michael Gove, who is our environment minister, who was a very strong Leaver but has abandoned those principles and now looks set to be the person selling Theresa May's deal to other MPs, which I think is quite shocking.
We previously, when you were on the show before, you previously said that you didn't see a second referendum happening. You said it was just like, that'd be too much of a rejection of democracy. Has the reaction to Theresa May's, this Theresa May plan, has that changed your mind in any way? Do you reckon there's slightly more of a chance of a second referendum?
I'm really torn on this question, and I'm thinking about it quite a lot, like all the time, every minute of every day, because I'm now wondering if we need to go back to the people in some fashion, because what has been done to the democratic vote is so horrendous and so horrific, in fact, and so historically unprecedented. You know, every adult got the vote in Britain in 1928. That's when finally women under the age of 30 were also allowed to vote. So that's the moment. 1928 is the moment at which all British adults get the right to vote. Not since 1928 have we had such an explicit attempt to overthrow a democratic vote. So historically speaking, this is incredibly important. And it looks increasingly likely to me either that May's deal will go through and we will still be in the EU, but in an even worse way than we were before, or it will be voted down in Parliament and we'll have a so-called people's vote, which is a very Orwellian phrase, which will just be used to beat down the public and make them change their minds. So both options are quite unattractive. So I'm now thinking quite carefully about whether we need another democratic statement to really put pressure on the political class and make it clear to them what we want, and that if they don't give it to us, then there's going to be serious trouble in the United Kingdom. You know, a lot of people are saying there's a civil war atmosphere in the UK at the moment, civil war without the guns, as a Guardian journalist referred to it, which is a very accurate description. You know, not since the 1640s, when we had an actual civil war between parliamentarians and monarchists, has the country been so hugely and neatly divided between two different political points of view about constitutional arrangements. So the political class is playing with fire, and I don't think they yet have faced up to the consequences of what will happen if they deny this largest vote in British history. So will there be a second referendum? I hope not, and I also, at the same time, think that we do need to do something to restate our political preference.
Okay, we now welcome back onto the show. Quick turnaround on Daniel Wilde appearances on the podcast, but we did need to get him on because of the disaster that the Victorian state election was for the Liberal Party. So at the moment we're recording this show, the Herald Sun has it at 52 seats for Labor, only 24 for the Coalition, 10 more are up for grabs. So Dan, initial thoughts, like what did you make of the election?
Well, it was a disaster, like you say. There's no other way of really describing it. I don't think anyone saw it coming. The loss of seats in sort of the Liberal heartland in the eastern suburbs, Box Hill, they're probably going to hold Hawthorne, but there was a bit of a scare there, so
yeah, no other way live to describe on air it. For the guy,
yeah, like, I mean, that's John Pesutto, is the member there, was he held himself together pretty well. He was on ABC, he was ABC, wasn't it? The coverage, yeah, yeah. And he was one of the panel participants, and he was actually watching the potential of his political career being over as he was live commentating.
Oh, so, really?
So that was interesting viewing, but good on him for keeping himself together. And it looks like he's going to win it, but it's going to be pretty marginal.
So yep. They normally put up people who are definitely going to win their seats so that that doesn't happen.
Yeah, because they can just lose themselves in analysis and coverage and not be like, hang on, what's going on?
Yeah.
I thought we had this in the bag. And then you also had Brighton was nearly lost. Brighton was looking hairy, and the guy who ran for Labour in Brighton was a 19-year-old kid. I think he was still living with his parents, L plates, and had joined the Labour Party 2 months ago. Like, if that's the guy that can nearly win Brighton, I think spending less than $1,500 on his campaign, the Libs are in serious trouble.
Yeah, and it shows some of the dangers associated with taking electorates for granted. I think there's a tendency sometimes to think, well, a seat has always been Liberal or Labour forever, and so it needs to be that way, and it will be that way for a long time. But what that mistakes is that it's people that vote, not electorates that vote. And so you need to stay in tune with the changing demographics of your electorate, the changing economic circumstances, you know, renters versus homeowners, family versus individuals versus group houses, and also the changing sort of nature of what's happening in the electorate in terms of their policy priorities. And if you take your finger off the pulse, then these kind of shocks can happen.
Yeah, because I live, well, I forgot to update my address when I moved out, so I had to go back.
Crime.
Yes.
That's a crime.
Well, yeah. No, I still voted legally, but did I just admit to a crime live on air?
I don't know.
Well, I voted, and in a, like, traditionally pretty, I voted in the exact electorate that I should have voted, just in case we need to cut anything before that.
Okay.
I voted, and Michael O'Brien's seat, which was, traditionally it's a Liberal Stalwart, they're never in any trouble. And no one, like, there was absolutely no one there handing out flyers or anything. No. And it actually ended up being pretty close.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot of stories like that out at, like, Box Hill, for example. There's just no posters, no one at train stations, no enthusiasm. So you got to wonder what was sort of going on in their minds. Did they just think, I mean, that's evidence to me that they didn't see it coming, or they're just really lazy, or both. But it's a strange outcome.
Well, let's talk a few issues, because there was a lot of issues in this election that you think would be something that they would be able to get some success out of, such as power costs, congestion, even crime and security law and order, that sort of thing. These are all areas that the Liberals do pretty well at. What do you think made them not do well at this time around?
Well, I mean, we take energy as an example. That's absolutely a bread and butter issue for Liberals, and not just for Liberals, but for, you know, Australians, middle class Australians in general.
Yeah,
I mean,
definitely.
Your energy costs, if you're a family, a small business owner, or a big business, I mean, that's one of the biggest costs. So that's a key issue. They didn't really prosecute a effective, consistent argument. Plus, we had Hazelwood, which was a coal-fired power station closed down, a major provider of electricity in Victoria, and we saw wholesale prices skyrocket after that was closed down. So the environment was ripe for prosecuting a strong argument on why we need to have a more market-based energy approach, having less government favoritism of solar and wind and pushing out coal. They didn't prosecute that argument. The Victorian Liberals said they were going to get rid of the state-based renewable energy target, which was good, but that's because they wanted the national one instead. They were going to have instead handing out or providing half price energy efficient fridges and televisions.
That's
that was their energy policy to get down costs.
Or the magic box, to bring it back to what we're talking about on the podcast. But
right.
Yeah,
to get down, you know, cost of living and electricity costs. There was a failure to prosecute a very coherent argument. And so when we get to this idea that there was these right-wing ideologues taking over the party, well, what's right-wing about handing out TVs? There's nothing right-wing about that. There's nothing conservative about that. There's nothing liberal about that. They didn't run a thoroughly liberal campaign.
Yeah, that's exactly it. Like, I don't think it's so much like they should have been more left-wing or right-wing, but there was just absolutely nothing to the platform. I don't remember seeing many ads. I don't know if any of my friends would have known what they stood for or what their campaign promises were. It was just completely empty.
Yeah, and that's coupled with, I think, Matthew Guy as a leader didn't get the coverage, and the people didn't really know about him a whole lot. Now, there's probably a range of reasons for that, but you're right. The profile of the Liberal Party, the personalities within the party, and the policies that they were promoting. I mean, I think law and order did come through, but obviously that wasn't enough. Maybe that was perceived as being too negative or too much of a marginal issue that wasn't affecting people in Box Hill as such. So there was definitely a failure to cut through, but that failure was because they didn't really have a clear agenda.
Yeah. So this sort of moves on to, we're talking very specific about Victoria, and we've got listeners from all around Australia. So let's talk about what the federal Liberals can learn from this one, or maybe some other state Liberal parties. Like, what are the lessons they need to learn from this one?
Well, they need to have a very clear and consistent policy platform. And they shouldn't be... There is a narrative out there that's being run by the left of the Liberal Party and the Labor Party and sort of journalists to the left, which is that... And this is what Julia Banks, who's the member for Chisholm in Victoria, who's just resigned as a member of the Liberal Party and is going to sit on the crossbench, has said, well, the party's been taken over by the reactionary right-wing ideologues. Well, I would ask, what's right-wing about the Paris Climate Agreement? What's right-wing about the renewable energy target? What's right-wing about having Section 18C? What's right-wing about having $500 billion in debt? You know, none of these are right-wing conservative policies. None of these are policies that speak to sort of mainstream Australians and the people in the electorate that they should be talking to. So I think that there is a real risk that the Liberal Party will take the wrong lesson from all of this and trying to go further to the left. And of course, the question that I also have to those that are saying that the party needs to have more of a, you know, quote unquote, moderate stance on things like climate change is, well, how much more to the left do you want them to go? They have a 20% renewable target. Labor has a 50% one. What should it be? 30, 40, 50? Do you want it more? 60, 70? You'll find that there is never any specifics given. It's just a general kind of criticism. And in Julia Banks's resignation statement, there's nothing specific. There's no identification of, I'm concerned about these three policies. Okay, fair enough. We can sort of agree to disagree. It's just a sort of a general sweeping statement that lacks specifics.
Yeah, you did see a lot of that coming out of people that lost their seats in Victoria. Was just like, oh, the party needs to change, without any specifics as to what or how. Mm. So, yeah.
Now, you've written in the past and spoken in the past about how the Liberal Party needs to forget it. Well, not forget, but realise that its traditional supporters are changing and refashion itself as a working or middle class party? Do you want to speak about that for a second?
Well, I think that's the natural...
Or a few seconds?
Yeah, sure. Just one.
Yeah.
I think that's sort of the natural home. If you look at what John Howard talks about, the aspirational class and people that want to get ahead, these are, you know, basically people that have median income earners with families, you know, working two jobs, trying to put the kids through school, probably working in maybe a small business or trying to work their way up a corporation of some sorts. Just trying to get by the best they can. They're very patriotic people that love the country. They don't like political correctness. They don't see anything wrong with Australia Day or our history. That's really the majority of Australians. And I think it's a shame that the Liberals... I mean, I'm not personally particularly concerned about the Liberal Party per se. What I'm concerned about is having a policy setting that's actually going to allow those Australians to succeed and prosper. And if you're spending too much time concerned about what someone in Wentworth thinks and spending too many resources trying to win that seat, and you're neglecting, say, Western Sydney or Southeast Melbourne or Western suburbs of Melbourne. I mean, if you look at... I don't see any reason why Liberals can't win Sunshine or Altona. I mean, why can't they win those seats? These are really aspirational, quintessential middle-class Australian suburbs of up-and-coming people, whether they're, you know, third-generation Australians or new migrants. They all want to have a better chance at success. And I think that there's an opportunity to really speak to these people about why we want them to have every opportunity in the world for them to be upwardly mobile and to succeed. And I think that that has been really lost.
Arguably by the Labor Party as well.
Well, that's exactly right. So that's right. I think there's a real opportunity. I said a backhand comment. There's probably 20% of voters out there that vote Labor that Liberals could get because a lot of the Labor Party now is obsessed with identity politics.
Yeah.
So they talk a lot about identity politics, multiculturalism, big immigration program. And, you know, that's if you want to embrace that agenda, that's fine. But that is an agenda that's very far removed from their traditional working class base. But they've been able to retain a lot of those working class seats because they haven't been electorally challenged by another party. And so that's where the opportunity is. And I think that's where really not just the future of Liberal Party, but I think if we look at much broader the future of liberalism in this country, how do we rejuvenate it? That is the area and the people that we need to be talking to.
Absolutely. So you had an op-ed with John Roskam, executive director here at the IPA, in today's Australian Financial Review. We're recording on Tuesday.
Yeah.
And that's sort of what you're saying. So a quote here: so the Liberals, both state and federal, are at risk of not knowing what they stand for because they're now trying to appeal to two different constituencies with very different belief systems. And that sort of brings into the idea that the Liberal Party's always been a broad church. There's always been classical Liberals, some Libertarians, and Conservatives. And I think what I'd say is the IPA is also kind of a broad church. We have Conservative staff members, we have Libertarian staff members, classical Liberal staff members, but we are all strongly united together by the ideas of free markets, limited government, freedom of speech. And you just, this might be talking more about the people that currently make up sitting Liberal Party members, but they're all infighting. So do you reckon like there's a way back from the Liberal Party in the sense of narrowing down into these clear things that unite Liberals, Libertarians and Conservatives?
Yeah, absolutely. I think so. And I think you summed that up very nicely that we do have a lot of differences within those different areas of political philosophy, but we are united by an idea that there are certain, you know, inalienable individual rights that everybody needs a basic level of in order to be able to flourish and succeed as individuals. And that involves limited government, a market-based economy and protections, legal protections for individual rights like freedom of speech, religion and association and rule of law, equality before the law. These are things I think vast majority of people that class themselves as liberals can agree upon. The issue there with things like Wentworth electorate and maybe some other inner city seats compared to, say, a seat like Lindsay in Sydney's West or Longman in Queensland is the differences are now quite significant. So if you look at climate change, population growth and sort of culture, those are three fairly big issues today. They weren't big issues 15, 20 years ago. So I think one political party, in this case Liberals, could straddle the line and have those seats. But today, because there is such a large policy cleavage between, you know, are you going to be in Paris Climate Agreement or not? Are you going to have coal-fired power or not? Those are big issues for working class Australians out in the suburbs, which aren't as big of a, like, people in who are wealthier can afford to pay the higher cost of electricity associated with these policies. And that's fine. That's their prerogative. But there is a real disconnect there. So I question whether that model is relevant today.
All right, we've talked a lot about the Liberal Party. We don't want to be too Victorian-centric, but what does a Labor government mean for Victoria?
It probably means a lot more spending, a lot more debt, debt-financed infrastructure. It'll mean more basically government intervention and more of what we've seen. Our new researcher here, research fellow Kurt Wallace, mm-hmm. has written a very fantastic piece of research and an op-ed that came out just before the election on Saturday. They went through some troubling elements of the Andrews government industrial relations agenda, as it would be cracking down on so-called the gig economy or the sharing economy, making it more difficult for people to participate in those more flexible working arrangements.
Get Uber Eats while you can.
Yeah, and that's the message. And probably more union involvement in construction. I mean, that's one of the things in Victoria.
I'll just jump in. So yeah, if you are interested in that paper out there, make sure you go to ipa.org.au. It's all there, the research, his articles, etc. Sorry to interrupt.
No, I was just going to say the broader public policy point here that's really interesting in Victoria and around the country is we have a growth model based on population growth rather than productivity growth. So we've had 27 years of straight economic growth. On an aggregate level, we know that Victoria is the fastest growing state population-wise. It's got a very healthy aggregate economic growth rate, but if you look at the per capita rate, it's not doing so well. So the whole way in which this show runs in Victoria is you have a lot of people moving here. That props up, that's what they need to prop up stamp duty because it elevates housing prices. It increases GST because you've got more people buying stuff from retailers. And of course, it boosts the construction industry, which is heavily influenced by unions. So that's really a payoff to the unions in a way, because you know if there's more people here, there's more demand for construction. So that's how the whole show works here. The problem is it's not sustainable because you can only fit so many people into a space. After a certain point of time, it's unsustainable. And like I say, the per capita growth isn't coming along. So my real long-term concern is Australia will have to move away from population growth as a growth strategy and back to productivity growth, because we used to have very strong productivity growth throughout the 90s because of a lot of the economic reform that stagnated. And so this really comes back to the classic things we talk about. You got to cut taxes, cut regulation, red tape, and get energy prices down.
All right, cool. Daniel, thanks so much for letting us know about the Victorian election. We'll talk to you very soon.
Thanks, my pleasure.
Okay, thank you to Brendan and Daniel for those interviews. So, once again, Brendan part two, we're going to start talking about freedom of speech, safetyism on campus, and his vision of the future. That is next week's show, so make sure you stick around for next week's show, because that's also very interesting stuff. Let's fly through some stories that made us laugh this week. So, one of the big things, and we probably could have talked about this at the start of the show, but it's also quite funny, and you know, there's a whole lot of other things that need to play out before we can start figuring out the pieces. But anyway, Julie Banks has resigned from the coalition.
Left the Liberal Party.
Left the Liberal Party. And she's now standing as an independent. So there's a whole lot of head-scratching for Scott Morrison as to what that means for the future of his government. But I did want to point out one part of her speech where she's talking about the reasons why she resigned. Led by members of the reactionary right wing, the coup aided by many MPs trading their vote for a leadership change in exchange for individual promotion, pre-selection endorsements, or silence, referring to this Dutton-Morrison-Turnbull thing.
Mm-hmm.
Pete, can you believe that people were trading their votes for personal gain?
I'm staggered.
Staggered.
That our representatives
politicians are trading away principles for their own power.
I'm shocked.
I'm shocked. I'm appalled.
I'm dismayed. That can't be right.
I'm angry.
That can't be right. So she's another one with the reactionary right-wing chat.
Yeah, yeah. So this is the thing, like, and we talk about it with Daniel, where there's so many people saying, well, the Victorian Liberal Party, you know, it just shows that you've got to stop being right-wing. Mm. And then the other side is saying, well, it shows you need to stop being left-wing. Mm. Does anyone know anything, like, that Matthew Guy really wanted apart from the free TVs?
Oprah.
Yeah, the Oprah policy. Like, genuinely, when I talk to my friends, like, the Oprah policy was the only one they knew about.
Oh, well, there you go. It was a winner then. Sorry, no, but it was also the emissions.
We're yeah,
the
yeah,
national
true.
Ones rather than the state ones.
Well, that's the huge one.
That's a principle stand, isn't it?
But like, that's the thing. It's like, is it left wing or right wing? It needs to pick a wing. Like, there's nothing there at the moment.
Just get a wing. All anyway, right. I'm shocked.
Just
shocked
pick
as
a wing.
You are.
Stick with it.
I'm as shocked as you are, James, about that.
Yeah. Okay. Shocking.
The other thing that happened this week.
Yes.
I think it was this week. Probably last week, actually.
No, November 16, he died.
Okay.
Sorry.
So I'll give you a bit of context around that.
Yeah,
spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert.
John Allen Chow, a US missionary, was killed by the Sentinelese, a small tribe who populate the North Sentinel Island near India. He was trying to teach them about Christianity. Now, this tribe is one of those uncontacted people where there's like 50 tribes of these people around the world.
Apparently. Yeah.
A lot of them in the Amazon who don't want to be contacted by outsiders. And so we generally don't contact them. And anyone who tries to speak to them gets killed, as happened to this fella. He got killed with spears. It's a very interesting thing.
I have read so many articles about this.
Yeah, it really captures people's imagination.
The mere concept of uncontacted tribes is beyond fascinating to me.
But do they think the rest of the world... They might think the rest of the world's uncontacted.
Yeah. That's always a thing of like, what would blow your mind the most? If you're an uncontacted tribe and you saw the modern world, what would be the most mind-blowing thing? Because here's my thing. I don't know how phones work. And I've lived with phones my whole life. I do not know how my voice appears out of someone else's phone hundreds of kilometers away and it sounds like me. I don't know how that works.
Yeah, no.
If you send me an email about how that works, I'm not going to read it because my eyes glaze over.
But
I've lived with phones my whole life. I know they work. How would it, like, if I didn't know about phones, like, what would that be about?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I think it's magic. And the other one's aeroplanes.
Oh, yeah.
It's like, oh, there's like particles of lighter under the wings, so there's 500 tons of metal in there.
Yeah. And that's just the thing.
I'm flying. That doesn't make sense to me. That can't be it.
Yeah, yeah. Like, if an engine goes out on an aeroplane, you just glide down. You don't fall out of the sky. That doesn't make sense.
That's not true.
I thought you were going to say, because one of the reasons that we know the Sentinelese are dangerous, like, there's always these rumors about fishermen, you know, they lose control of their boat, wind up on the shore.
Yeah, okay.
But the actual footage that we have is the Indian Army were doing drive rounds after the Boxing Day tsunami back in 2004.
Okay.
And came across, like, they knew they were there, and they're like, oh, these people still okay. And they just came out with bows and arrows and stuff. But seeing a helicopter the first time, you'd be like, what is that?
Yeah.
What is that? Why is it making that noise?
Why is it flying?
Why is it flying?
I just think it was a bird.
But yeah, the biggest bird that also sounds angry.
Angry bird.
Well, this is the thing. Like, the guy knows all of the dangers.
Yeah.
And he spends 3 days around them. And he's like, the first day... It's clear they don't want any part of him.
Oh, really? He spent 3 days there?
He spent 3 days, like, you know, sailing around doing recon. Second day, the story goes that he started singing worship songs and hymns from the boat to the Sentinelese who were on the shore.
Didn't fly?
Didn't fly. What did fly was an arrow that pierced his Bible. So, I don't, that's like a scene straight out of Heart of Darkness, but like an arrow straight through the Bible. And he's like, all right, I'm getting up out of here. But he still goes back the third day, and that's the day that he died.
Okay.
Yeah. So.
Was he alone, like literally alone?
Well, I think he had a guide, but I don't know about the third day when he died. But I think he was the only one that died. So you would have thought if there were other people there, they also would have met their end. Yeah. Bad call. That call by him.
Yeah, but you've got a solution to this problem, don't you?
Oh, so yeah. So this led to me and Pete discussing how would we contact the Sentinelese or what do we reckon should happen?
We take on the weighty issues so you don't have to.
So last week we had the PR help for the Liberal candidate who had a pretty bad go on spears.
Did not
work. So let's PR with the Sentinelese. Like, how would we publicly relate the outside world to the Sentinelese? Can I start my theory?
Yeah.
After it worked so well in North Korea,
I
think we just deployed Dennis Rodman.
Yeah.
And he just goes there. We throw him out of a helicopter with a parachute and a copy of the 1997 NBA Finals.
Yeah.
And we just let Dennis Rodman work his magic. And he's undefeated. This is a man that unites cultures.
He'll come back a week later and go, yeah, it's sorted.
It's done.
They're happy.
And we go back and they're all just amazing basketball players and peace is secured.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, look, that's, mate.
And just so you know.
It's not the worst idea I've ever heard.
Well, just so you know that Dennis Rodman is on the top of his game.
Mm-hmm.
On Twitter today, someone posted a video of like an old basketball match and he just responded, full stop, four spaces, and then the word basketball. So he's able to identify things. His cognitive abilities cannot be questioned right now.
Apparently. That's good, mate. Oh, apparently him and Luke Longley were really close.
Yeah, they were playing the same team.
Nah, but like you can, you know, they were best mates.
Oh, right.
Like, can you imagine?
I think if you win three championships together.
Like, no, but like they were better mates than the other people.
Okay, fair enough. Opposites do attract. I reckon you just throw Rodman out of a helicopter and he's a culture warrior.
Yeah, I mean, we should put him all around the world, all the trouble spots.
Yeah, until he runs out, like, he's not caused a war yet. Say what you will about Dennis Rodman, he has not caused a war.
Yeah.
So, yeah. That's all I'm going to say.
Cool.
All right, we got one more thing. So for our friends at the Center for Independent Studies, they are hosting the next Liberty and Society Conference, Liberty and Society 2019. Applications are now open if you want to go to that. Mm. This conference runs every year. It's absolutely awesome. This year, it's running from the 10th to the 12th of May. Center of Independent Studies, really cool organization. We've had a fair few of them on the podcast in the past. Yep. And Tom Switzer a few weeks ago.
Tom was there last night, actually.
Oh, I didn't see him. Oh, that would have been cool. But yeah, really great organization committed to free markets and freedom. So if you do want to go to that conference, make sure you're going to the CIS website and signing up. All right, that's it for this week's show. Brendan O'Neill, Daniel Wild, thanks again. Thank you guys so much for listening. We're available on iTunes, Spotify, Podbean, all of the major podcast apps. And if you are listening on iTunes, make sure you're leaving us at 5-star rating. And and it was so cool seeing so many fans of the podcast last night.
It was great.
There were so many members coming up to me just going like, how good's the podcast? I wish Pete wasn't on
okay,
it.
Okay, mate. Yeah, yeah. Sit on
it. You're the star. You're the best part. Yeah. Maybe it should just be you. They were just saying things.
It was cool to meet listeners.
Yeah. But seriously, it was great seeing so many fans of the podcast. And so make sure if you are listening on iTunes, you're leaving us that 5-star rating. And if you do want to become a member of the IPA, Nina, what can they do?
Visit the website, ipa.org.au, and click on the join button. And starting as low as $22 per year, you become one of the voice of freedom in Australia.
All right, cool. See you guys next week.
See you later.
If we make it through today.